Thank you again, Brother Chairman, and my dear brothers and sisters. Genesis chapter 10. In the book of Genesis, we're given the story of the sons of Noah as they populated the earth. We're told in Genesis chapter 10, and reading from the first verse, it says there, "Now these are the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and unto them were sons born after the flood, the sons of Japheth." Now, just before we go on to have a look at the names of the tribes in Genesis 10, you'll notice what it says about Japheth, by the way, in Genesis chapter 9 and verse 27. It said there, "God shall enlarge Japheth." God shall enlarge Japheth, and he shall dwell in the tents of Shem. So who were the Japhethites then? Well, we believe, of course, that the Japhethites were the Indo-European races. That whereas the sons of Ham spread into the African continent, and the sons of Shem spread across the Asian continent, that the sons of Japheth moved northwards into the great European continent. So they were known, or they came to be known, as the Indo-European races, and they were known, of course, for both their inventiveness and their exploratory zeal. So much so that we're told in verse 2, it says, "The sons of Japheth, Gomer and Magog and Madai and Javan and Tubal and Meshech and Tiras, and the sons of Gomer, Ashkenaz and Riphthah and Tagama, and the sons of Javan, Eliasha and Tarshish and Kittim and Dedanim, by these were the isles of the Gentiles divided in their lands, everyone after his tongue, after their families in their nations." The isles of the Gentiles would be divided by the sons of Japheth, who would push out and push out and push out in their exploratory zeal to conquer worlds and places unknown. But amongst the places that they conquered was the region of Europe itself. So now let's just see if we can identify then the names of the sons here in Genesis chapter 10 and verse 2. So who have we got? Well, the first son is Gomer. Anyone know who Gomer's supposed to be? Any thoughts on that? So Gomer is normally equated with France. Then we've got Magog. Who's Magog normally equated with? And the answer is Magog is normally equated with the region of Germany. Then we've got Madai. And I believe that the Madai of verse 2 here is the area of Iran. It's the same Hebrew word translated Media elsewhere. The Medes and the Persians who inhabited the area of Iran. So the Madai here, we believe, relates to the area of Iran. What about Javan? Well, Javan is really Ionia, which relates to the region of Greece and the Ionian Peninsula. And then we've got Tubal and Meshech that relate to the area of Russia. And finally we've got Tiras in verse 2, and Tiras is where we think that the word Thracia comes from, and Thracia is the area of modern Bulgaria. So let's just put all that on a map, shall we, and let's just see what we look like then in terms of tracing the sons of Japheth. So what we've got is that the Japhethites spread out into the European continent. So Javan is the area of Greece, Tiras or Thracia is the area of Bulgaria, Tagama is of course across here in the Turkish Peninsula, Meshech and Tubal is to the north, Magog was central Europe, and Gomer was over here. By the way, if anyone's not convinced about those locations, might I suggest that I think one of the best analyses that I've read of those locations is Brother John Alfrey's book on Ezekiel 1 to 39, In discussing the nations of Ezekiel 38, he gives, I think, the most authoritative textual examination of those tribes and where they really were based that I've ever seen written, I think, in the Brotherhood. And I think that he gives a very excellent summary in that book. So what we know from this then is as follows, and I really only want to draw attention to one aspect of Genesis here, and that's this. That Gomer and Magog were brothers. Not only were they brothers, but they both migrated to the same area. They migrated to the region of Europe, and they dwelt in contiguous regions, the one over against the other. Gomer to the west of Europe, or Western Europe, and Magog a little to the north in Central Europe. But that's where these two sons of Japheth penetrated in their zeal to explore lands unknown. So that's all quite interesting, because now we're going to come back to Revelation chapter 13, and having had a brief look at the beast system in our previous talk, we're going to just take a note of Revelation 13. Now, maybe just before I show you that Revelation 13 picture again, all right, so Revelation 13. So remember how we found then in our previous session that the beasts of Revelation, we think, are an entirely logical and natural progression of the beast, the fourth beast of Daniel chapter 7, and that the book of Revelation gives, as it were, its own clue. In as much as when we come to Revelation chapter 1, it says, go back to Daniel 7, go back to Daniel 7, go back to Daniel 7. Now, in Revelation 13, then, do you notice what it says concerning one of these beasts, which happens to be this one here? It mentions in verse 2, the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion, and the dragon gave him his power and his seat and great authority. So we notice that the beast of Revelation chapter 13, or at least the one that arises in this particular place, actually embraces the symbology of Daniel's four beasts. There is reference to the lion, reference to the bear, reference to the leopard, and reference to the dragon. So the four beasts of Daniel 7 are seen in some way to be reflected now in the developing system of the beasts in Revelation chapter 13. Now, these beasts of Revelation 13, I should just make the point that they are, in a sense, concurrent. So what do we mean by concurrent? We mean that the beast of Revelation 13 verses 1 to 10 and the beast of Revelation 13 verses 11 to 18 and, for that matter, the beast of Revelation 12, that certainly those three beasts are, in a sense, concurrent. That is, they both exist, or they all exist, at the same point of time. Now, did you notice that we can prove that in Revelation chapter 13? For example, verse 2. It says there, and the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of the bear, his mouth as the mouth of a lion, and the dragon gave him his power. So the beast of Revelation 13 verse 2 must exist at the same time as the dragon, because the dragon gives power to the beast. Now look at verse 12. Verse 11 for connection. I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth. He had two horns like a lamb. He spake as a dragon. And he exercises all the power of the first beast before him. But many of you will know that both in the Greek and in the Hebrew, the words or the phrase before him can be, and in often should be translated, in his presence, in his face. So the second beast of Revelation chapter 13 verses 11 and 12 exercises the power of the first beast in the presence of the first beast. So both beasts are there at the same time. Now have a look at verse 15. It says, and he had power to give life unto the... Now who's the he of verse 15? Well, it's the second beast, the beast of the earth. He had power, verse 15, to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. So we've got another beast in this chapter known as the image of the beast, which is not shown on our chart there, but that also exists at the time of the beast of Revelation chapter 13 verse 12. So you see, one of the things that we learn therefore about the beast of Revelation 13 is that while in a sense they may be tracking successive years of history, that they were at times all to be seen on the face of the Roman continent at the same period of history or time. Now let's just have a look at that then and see how that actually worked its way out, because I think that this is actually there was a marvellous set of symbols here, you see, to describe what was going on across the face of Europe during these years. So here we have the approximate areas of the symbols of Revelation chapter 13. The beast of the sea that we find in Revelation 13 in verse 2, we believe relates essentially to the Mediterranean countries, and it focused on France. It focused on France and the Latin kingdoms. And it centered on the western part of Europe. It relates to the history of that area down throughout certain centuries of time. But at the same time, the dragon existed over here. And the dragon existed in the part of the Eastern Roman Empire. And it wasn't there at a different time. It was there simultaneously, at the same time that the beast of the sea existed, because we're expressly told, by the way, aren't we, in Revelation, that the beast of the sea was given its power by the dragon. So whatever you think the dragon is, you've got to explain how the dragon gave power to the beast of the sea. I've yet to hear a sensible or rational interpretation of that, taking any futuristic view of prophecy. The beast of the earth of Revelation 13 and verses 11 and 12, we believe is the beast of the central region here, which was in fact focused in the area of Germany itself. So one of these beasts was related to France, and one of these beasts was related to Germany. Now that's interesting, because that's the very two sons of Japheth that we saw migrated in Genesis chapter 10 across into this area. So the sons of Gomer and the sons of Magog, we believe, became the two centre parts for the two beasts of Revelation chapter 13, the beast of the sea and the beast of the earth. So the Franco-German connection has been there with the beasts of this area right down through time. Now, you'll probably know what happened, by the way, is that... Then we've also got, just lastly, the image of the beast, and we believe that the image of the beast was none other than the papacy itself. At the time it was given some territory, given some land, and as a result of that became like a little beast all by itself, a proper little kingdom. And it became a proper little kingdom because it got given land. Now, by the way, just so that we confirm we're all on the same history lesson, so now, does anyone know what happened in terms of land? Can anyone tell me the story of the land that was given to the papacy? Anyone tell me historically when that was and the circumstances that brought that about? Anyone know? Roughly what sort of period of time are we talking about? Sorry? Napoleon, a bit too late. Charlemagne, that's considerably earlier than Napoleon, yes. Yes, I think that's around about the right time. Around about the time of Charlemagne and his father and grandfather, there was a lot of kerfuffle going on in this European continent. And by the way, you see, I think that one of the marvellous things about the Revelator, the giving of these visions to John, was that all of these symbols were used to describe a tremendous amount of things happening on the face of the European continent. And it couldn't all be described with one beast. So all these different things are seen to happen, and yet they outwork themselves in the most amazing and marvellous way. Now, one of the things that happened was that the papacy received some territory. And the bit of territory it got, by the way, was this bit right in the middle, a piece of land around about that size, known as the Papal States. They got three pieces of territory. And in the course of those wars and counter-wars that went on, during which the papacy gained that territory, courtesy of Charlemagne and his father, three of the barbarian kingdoms, that's right, were overthrown. And we believe that this was a fulfillment, don't we, of Daniel chapter 7, where three little horns were overthrown, that a new little horn might emerge. So the little horn of Daniel 7, which was the papacy, is the same as the image of the beast of Revelation chapter 13, that grew to power because of the territory that had been given to it. Now, what actually happened when Charlemagne came along, by the way, was this. He was the king of the Franks. Were Franks German or French? What thinkest thou? They were German, weren't they? And yet, they ended up, of course, famous as far as the French people were concerned. And, in fact, when Charlemagne finally put it all together, this is the area that he finally controlled, and this was really the beginning. Well, this was really the Holy Roman Empire, the extent of the Holy Roman Empire by the time that Charlemagne died in AD 814. Now, I want you to notice something interesting, because, you see, what Charlemagne did, and this has been the story of Europe ever since, Charlemagne actually brought together Germany and France, and he locked them together into one empire. Of course, Germany wasn't called Germany in those days, it was called Austrasia, and France was called Neustria. And Charlemagne successfully brought together these two crucial areas, plus Aquitaine and Burgundy and Lombardy and Bavaria, and successfully united into one giant empire the power of France and the power of Germany. Now, that beast system broke up later on in history and became the beast of the sea and the beast of the earth again, and in two separate sort of places. And I don't know if you know sort of too much about the history, but how long did the Holy Roman Empire last for? That empire that Charlemagne founded, how long did the Holy Roman Empire last for? You know? He was crowned in AD 800. You know when the Holy Roman Empire officially terminated? 1806. And in fact, the reason for the termination was that Napoleon, of course, wanted to recreate the Holy Roman Empire. And it's quite interesting, actually, because you see, what Charlemagne did is he was a German, and he created an empire by conquering France. Along came Napoleon and said, I want to see the Holy Roman Empire again. Now, who was he? Was he French, by the way? Was Napoleon French? No, he wasn't. What was he? He was a Corsican. But he was a ruler of France. He said, well, I want to recreate the Holy Roman Empire, and to do that, I've got to conquer Germany. So he was moving from France in the opposite direction to Charlemagne, but for the purpose of trying to accomplish the same thing. Interestingly enough, of course, it was when Napoleon was crowned that, of course, he did a different thing to Charlemagne, because who crowned Charlemagne? The answer is the Pope. Who crowned Napoleon? And the answer is, well, the Pope thought he was going to be the person that did it, and the Pope stood there with the crown in his hands, and Napoleon came striding in and came right up to the Pope, took the crown right out of his hands, turned around and put his back to the Pope and stuck it on his own head, and thereby separated church from state and said, this might be the Holy Roman Empire again, but I'm not Charlemagne and you're not the emperor. That's effectively what he was saying to the Pope. And he forever separated church and state that had once been bound together in the days of the Holy Roman Empire. So the story that I'm really trying to unfold here is simply this, that down through the ages, Germany and France have been inextricably locked together in the story of the beast system as it moved across the face of Europe. And in fact, the Holy Roman Empire ceased we believe in the year 1806. Well, we don't believe it, we know it for a fact, because Francis II abdicated from the Holy Roman Emperorship and relinquished his title. And it was around about that time that Napoleon was busy scurrying across the face of Europe. And this is what he did, by the way. Come and have a look at Revelation chapter 16. Because you know that in Revelation 16, there was the period that involved the pouring out of the vials. And again, I mean, this could be a study in itself, because the pouring out of the vials is an amazing thing historically, to see how in fact that was so perfectly fulfilled in the marchings of Napoleon throughout the length and breadth of Europe. But one of the things that it says that he did in Revelation 16 and verse 10, it says, "And the fifth angel poured out his vial upon the seat of the beast, and his kingdom was full of darkness, and they gnawed their tongues for pain." Now, what was the seat of the beast in ancient times? Well, by the way, the seat of the beast changed. When Charlemagne was head of the Holy Roman Empire, the seat of the beast was a place just here called Aachen, or Aix-la-Chapelle. By the time Frederick the Great, or Frederick of Barbarossa, became the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, the seat of the beast had moved to Frankfurt, over here. And by the time Francis II abdicated, the seat of the beast had moved to Vienna in Austria. And that's where the fifth vial of Revelation 16 and verse 10 was poured out. It was poured out upon the seat of the beast in Vienna and upon the seat of the beast in Rome. The one where the emperor was and the other where the pope was. And thereby the beast system, as it were, its power was absolutely stripped for the time being, which is why we believe that Revelation 17 is so significant, that when it prophesies that the beast is suddenly alive and well, and there's a woman riding upon the beast all over again, having just been well nigh destroyed by the fifth vial judgment of Revelation 16, well, we believe that what Revelation is telling us, therefore, is that there must be, despite the fact that Napoleon brought all those things to an end, there must be, in fact, let me just cover my thing up, a latter day revival of the beast system in the earth. Because when Napoleon poured his judgments out on the seat of the beast in Revelation 16 and verse 10, the beast, as it were, officially ceased to exist. The Holy Roman Empire came to an end. The power that held France and Germany together was gone. And yet look what the Bible says, or look what the book of Revelation says about the beast system. It says in Revelation 14 and verse 11, "And the smoke of their torment ascendeth up forever and ever, and they have no rest day nor night who worship the beast and his image." Now Revelation 14, we believe, is set at the time of the coming of Christ. "But the beast is alive," says Revelation 14. In Revelation chapter 15 it says, "And I saw, as it were, a sea of glass mingled with fire, and them that had gotten victory over the beast and over his image." Now, when is there a sea of glass? And the answer is, that's in the time to come, isn't it? When Christ returns. And yet it speaks about those who gain victory over the beast at that time. So there has to be a latter-day beast. Revelation 16 says, "And I saw three unclean spirits like frogs come out of the mouth of the dragon, and out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet." And this is at the time of the battle of Armageddon. So there has to be a latter-day beast. Revelation chapter 17 says, in verses 13 and 14, "These have one mind, and shall give their power and strength unto the beast, and shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them." So when the Lamb comes, the beast has to be there. And finally, Revelation chapter 19 and verse 20 says, and the beast was taken, and with him the false prophet, these were both cast into the lake of fire burning with brimstone. And Revelation 19 is all about the judgments that Christ will bring in the earth when he goes riding forth upon his horse with the sword, the sharp sword with which he smites the nations. So whatever might have happened to the beast in the 1800s, and we believe that certainly the beast system was punished, these references in Revelation 14 and 15 and 16 and 17 and 19 clearly require that we expect to see a revival of the system of the beast at the time of the end. Now, what's interesting about all that is this. Do you notice that in all of those passages, you might not have noticed, but it doesn't say which beast is to be revived at the time of the end. Have a look at Revelation chapter 16, by the way. You notice what it says in Revelation 16 and verse 13. It says, I saw three unclean spirits like frogs come out of the mouth of the dragon, and out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. Now, the question is, how do those three things relate to what we saw in Revelation 13? Is there a dragon in Revelation 13? Yes. Is there a dragon in Revelation 16? Yes. Is there a beast in Revelation 13? Yes. There's two beasts, actually. There's a beast of the sea and a beast of the earth. Is there a beast in Revelation 16? Yes. Is there an image of the beast in Revelation 13? Yes. Is there an image of the beast in Revelation 16? No. What replaces the image of the beast in Revelation 16? Answer, the false prophet. So, by the way, in terms of any prophetic interpretation that you want to give to the beasts, one of the things that you need to explain is, why does the image of the beast of Revelation 13 become the false prophet of Revelation 16, and what has caused that change to take place? Good question. Fortunately, there's a very good answer, which is probably going to keep till tonight in terms of our prophecy forum session tonight. But any good interpretation is going to have to explain that change. So when Revelation 16 says that there is a the mouth of the frog comes out of the mouth of the beast, it doesn't say which beast. Is it the beast of the sea or the beast of the earth? The answer is we don't know. When the latter day beast is revived, we're not told which beast of Revelation 13 it is. My personal view, by the way, is it's likely to be more the beast of the earth, but I think that it probably relates to both. And that's significant because, remember, our theme this afternoon is the role of France and Germany in the story of this beast system at the time of the end. You know, many people have the dream of recreating that system of the beast down through time. Napoleon. Anyone else? Bismarck. Did someone say Bismarck? Hitler. Yes, absolutely. They all had the same objective, which was to recreate that system of central power in Europe that bound together the French and the German into one particular area. Now, the interesting thing about all that was that even though people had the dream, no one was in fact able to accomplish it. And all of a sudden, something really interesting happened on the world scene, or on the stage rather, of Europe, and that was this. This is an extract from a children's book, by the way, about Europe. It says, the Holy Roman Empire was founded on the achievements of Charlemagne and continued at least as a title for 1,000 years until the days of Napoleon. The idea of a united Europe governed as one community and completely devoted to the Christian faith. For Christian, we should, of course, read Catholic, shouldn't we? Completely devoted to the Catholic faith, still lives on as an ideal. The European common market owes something to this traditional dream. Now you see, the remarkable thing was that all these leaders arose on the continent of Europe who wanted to try and bring back Germany and France together. None of them were able to accomplish it from the days of Charlemagne onwards, and yet all of a sudden something happened that nobody expected would lead to what it did lead to, and yet it accomplished the very thing that prophecy expected us, or that we expected to see because of prophecy, and that's this, that the EEC, as it was called, began to bring about the Franco-German axis of things again, and the beast was seen to be revived in the earth in the latter days. Now, I know this is all sort of boring history stuff from Europe, but it's quite useful to know just a little bit about this in order that you might see the significance of what's been going on in Europe since about the 1950s. Does anybody know how the EC or the EU began? Does anyone know the very beginnings of the story? Let me just put a map up so that I can show you this. Anyway, does anyone know how it began? It's before the Treaty of Rome. Yep, it dates back before the Treaty of Rome. Well, it basically started like this. So imagine that here is the face of Europe after World War II. Germany had already plunged the face of Europe into two world wars. Here's Germany here. Where did they get their steel from and their coal from to manufacture their armaments and their munitions? Anybody know? Where did Germany develop all of its industrialization? And the answer is they were developed in what was known as the Ruhr and the Ruhr and Saar basins. Now the Ruhr and Saar basins are just here. They're on the ancient borderline between France and Germany. And Germany harnessed those industrial areas for the production of steel and coal, and along came France after World War II and said, Germany is never, ever going to be allowed to do that again. And so they proposed that they would actually combine the economies of France and Germany together in that particular area, which was their most bitterly disputed geographic sector, the Ruhr and Saar Basin region that lay between the French and the Germans. So what they did is they established what was called the European Coal and Steel Commission. And that was formed in 1951. And the objective of that was to inextricably link France and Germany together economically so that Germany could never again launch war across the face of Europe by itself. It would be locked for all time with France. And that seemingly harmless, politically sensible move, no one appreciated, I don't think, at that stage how momentous that would be in terms of the outworking of Bible prophecy and what subsequently happened. And as our brother chairman has rightly said, 6 years later, so this is 1951, 6 years later in 1957, the first of the great treaties was formed that governed the European Union. And that, of course, was the Treaty of Rome. Why was it called the Treaty of Rome? Because it was the six founder states who signed the treaty, and it was signed in Rome. Does anyone know exactly where it was signed? For 10 marks. Not just in Rome, but where exactly was the treaty signed? Anybody know? The six founder members of the European Union. It was signed in the Lateran Palace. Where's the Lateran Palace? Anybody know? It's part of the Vatican. It was signed in the Lateran Palace. And do you know that the six signatories by the six founder states just all happened to be Roman Catholic signatories? And they all went and celebrated Mass with the Pope immediately after signing the treaty. Wow. So the woman riding upon the beast was well and truly involved at the very start of that process by which the, uh, the European system of things would be developed. Well, of course, you'll know that subsequent to that time there's been a raft of other treaties. So what's the other great treaty? Well, there's at least two other notable treaties. Anyone know the other notable treaties concerning the European Union? Most famous one is probably the Treaty of Maastricht. And the Treaty of Maastricht, which was signed up here, was significant in certain respects because it began to pledge the European Union towards ever closer and closer integration. Of course, what they said at the start of all this was it's purely economic, just to do with trading goods and services. Nothing more than just good economy, good money management, good taxation. That's all this is about. Now, it was always about something far more significant than that. And by the way, do you know who the first president of the European Union was? A man called Walter Hallstein. Now, who might he be? Well, he was the foreign minister of Germany. And who was the proponent of the whole concept from the start? A man called Jean Monnet. He was a Frenchman. Wherever you go in the story of the European Union, you'll find Frenchmen and Germans absolutely prominent in every step of the way as we come through. So, in fact, what we've got is this. This is the reality now in terms of where we've come over those years, because it's not all that long ago, really. I mean, there are quite a few people living in this room who were there at the signing of the Treaty of Rome. Not there in the Lateran Palace, but they were alive. They were alive at the time of the signing of this treaty. They were alive at the time of the signing of the Treaty of Maastricht and at the subsequent Treaty of Nice, which has just been concluded. So, you see, the beast is alive and well. And now we've got the latter-day beast, and it doesn't live in Vienna anymore, as it did in the days of Napoleon, and it doesn't live in Aachen, as it did in the days of Charlemagne. It lives in Brussels, because in Brussels is the European Commission and the European Council and the Council of Ministers. These are the key centres, or some of the key centres, of the European system of things. Then in Luxembourg, we've got the European Court of Justice, and in Strasbourg, we've got the European Parliament itself. By the way, that stained glass window is in the window of the European Court of, it's in the European Parliament buildings in Strasbourg, that picture of the Virgin Mary with the 12 stars holding the crown of Charlemagne. Now, do you notice something interesting about those sites? You notice this. Where's Brussels and where's Luxembourg and where's Strasbourg? And the answer is, they're all on the ancient axis between France and Germany. They all lie on the dotted line between those two nations. It's the place where they've been rubbing against one another for centuries. And I think that's a deliberate thing, that the European Union has deliberately built itself so that it lies exactly, as it were, between France and Germany, because that's the basis of the revival of this system of thing at the time of the end. Now, you'll know that Britain's been a bit of a sort of problem, really, as far as the European market's concerned, because they're not sure whether they want to be in or out, or not sure whether they want to have the money or not have the money, and so on and so forth. And we really don't know what's going to happen. So from a prophetical point of view, it's always been our anticipation that ultimately Britain probably doesn't belong there. She's certainly not prepared to commit her money resources at the moment. And you know the surprising thing about the pound? Is that the British pound and the British trading economy is actually going ahead in leaps and bounds by them not having the euro at the moment. So who knows what will happen. In fact, let me tell you something interesting about Charlemagne's empire. Do you know that Charlemagne's empire came up round here, and up across here, and along here, down here, across here, down here? And the interesting thing about Charlemagne's empire is it never included Great Britain. So when we see a revival of the beast system of things at the time of the end, if it follows the lines geographically of the old Holy Roman Empire, then we wouldn't be surprised to see perhaps further developments whereby, in fact, the gulf widens rather than decreases between Britain and the other nations. Now, of course, one of the things that Britain did to control its own involvement with the European Union is that they had certain powers of veto. You'll remember that there were certain nations that had veto powers. Does any nation have the power of veto now over the European system? Anyone know? Is the power of veto still available? Hands up those that think it is. Hands up those that think the power of veto is gone. Hands up those who don't want to put their hands up because they're not sure. And the answer is that as the treaties progressively get stronger, all the veto powers that Britain once had are gone. And this year, brothers and sisters, this year in 2002, a special convention has been established to draft a new constitution for the European Union and to amalgamate all the provisions of previous treaties into one new special treaty. And I can tell you now that one of the clauses of those provisions are that no one can block the future development of where the Union is going, and that if some members want to cooperate more closely than other members, then they are entitled to do so in terms of the legislation. Let me just read you an interesting little snippet about the Franco-German axis of the European system. This is the beast of the sea and the beast of the earth cooperating together at the time of the end. The French foreign minister, Hervé de Charette, confirmed this. He said, "The Franco-German axis must continue to fulfill its federating function. The single currency project is the principal and only European federating project. The powerfully federalist character of this project has yet to be appreciated." Senior European economists affirm that decisions are partly rigged in advance by the two largest member states, Germany and France, which are bound by the terms of their bilateral treaty of 1963 to reach as far as possible an analogous position ahead of meetings at the Council of Ministers. Now, I don't know if you followed what that's saying, but when the Council of Ministers in Brussels sits down to make a decision on something, France and Germany have already had a little chat about the subject. And they've already decided what they're going to do. Because they've got a treaty that requires them to do that before they come to the Council. So guess who's driving the European Union? And the answer is France and Germany. Absolutely and totally France and Germany. And by the way, this overhead, which I did a wee while ago, is now out of date. It does include the European Central Bank, by the way. European Central Bank is in Frankfurt. The Germans won when it came to the central banking. So a man called Willem Duisenberg is currently the president. He's going to step down in about 18 months. And his role is going to be taken over by a man called Jean-Claude Trichet. Who might he be? Why, a Frenchman taking over from a German. The whole system is very much under the control of the French and the German, because this to us is the beast of the sea and the beast of the earth of earlier times, revived in the latter days as we expected it would be. By who? Who's revived that beast system of things? And the answer is, so this is really where our title comes from, been revived by the two sons of Japheth, hasn't it? This is Gomer and Magog cooperating together at the time of the end so that the beast system might be seen to live. In fact, this article says, "This state of affairs makes a nonsense of John Major's refrain that Britain should be at the heart of Europe. The heart of Europe, says this article, is already occupied by France and Germany." And so it is. And they are very much at the forefront of the whole story, because it's the sons of Japheth that have really remarkably brought that system of the beast to life in the latter days. fact, here's just a breakdown of those EU groups, by the way, in another format. So we've got the European Commission, based in Brussels. We've got the European Council, based in Brussels. The Council of the European Union. The European Parliament, based in Luxembourg. The Court of Justice. The Court of the Auditors of the EC. The European Central Bank, that controls the euro, or the euro, as Europeans call it. And the European Investment Bank. And there's two other organisations that have now been added to the EU bodies. Does anyone know what's been added to that group of things in recent times? Anybody know? The Commission, the Council, the Parliament, the Court of Justice, the Central Bank. Two more European institutions have been established. One of them is Europol, the European Police Force. So Europe has its own special police force dedicated to law and order throughout the European Union. Oh, and one more thing. There's also a little group called the European Rapid Reaction Force. Do you know what the European Rapid Reaction Force is actually another name for? The European Army. There is going to be a European Army. Forget about NATO. There's going to be a European Army. And the Germans are delighted. They want to have a European Army. They want to contribute to a European Army. And so do the French. They want to control it together. So not only are there all those organisations established in the European Union, but there is also now the European Police Force and the European Army. Now, as far as the currency goes, I was actually in Europe about, where are we now, February. I was there in January on the day. I was actually in Germany at the time that the currency was being changed over from the Deutsche Mark to the new Euro. And there were all these queues of Germans all standing patiently to go into the bank to get their new currency and get rid of the old stuff. And of course it's all changed over quite dramatically. So what do you think the significance of all the money business is? Well, I'll tell you. Let me just cover up a wee bit here. This is an extract from a Time magazine in 1997. Not only is there no prospect of a war in Europe, but the ancient enemies, France and Germany at the centre, have integrated their economies, torn down internal trade barriers, and faced the world increasingly as a single unit. They're getting ready to take control of monetary policy and interest rates away from their sovereign nations and turn it over to a European Central Bank. They've already done it. But the idea behind that is more political than economic. That consultations on numbers will evolve into decision-making in concert, first on domestic policies and then in foreign and defence fields. A quotation from the previous president of France, Valéry Giscard d'Estaing: when we have the same currency, we will feel the need for common institutions. Do you know why the European Union have pressed so hard for a common currency? It's got nothing to do with money, brothers and sisters, and everything to do with the fact that when you're spending the same money and buying the same goods, you start to think alike. And do you know where that leads to? That leads to political union. And the whole aim and thrust of France and Germany is not just to have an economic unit with the same currency, it's to actually bind all of this together into one enormous empire, the United States of Europe. And the French and the Germans, by the way, are quite open about it. Oh, and by the way, they've decided that they want to add something to the European Parliament and the European Commission and the European Police Force and the European Court of Justice and the European Central Bank and the European Army. They're going to make one more appointment as well. You know what it is? They're going to make one particular appointment of one position. You know what it is? They've decided that they're going to have a European president. And the European president will be in charge of the whole system. And it's been suggested that that president should in fact be crowned. Sort of like a king. And guess what they've proposed that he should wear as the crown for his presidency? Why, the crown of Charlemagne. So you see, we believe that the very system of the beast that was seen in ancient times, the Roman system of things, is alive and well today. Not because of a leader that arose to conquer Europe by war. Not because of strategy between the French and the German by means of military conquest, but by means of what appeared to be a perfectly innocent development, the establishment of the European Coal and Steel Commission that has grown into the monster that we see today of the European Union. Absolutely devoted to Roman Catholicism, by the way, and to Roman Catholic principles. Now you see, remember what Revelation said. This has come back to Revelation chapter 17 and conclude on this thought. Perhaps Revelation 16. So Revelation 16 verse 13 says, I saw three unclean spirits like frogs come out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. For they are the spirits of devils, working miracles, which go forth unto the kings of the earth and of the whole world to gather them to the battle of the great day of God Almighty. And the thing is, brothers and sisters, again we say, as we said in our first session this afternoon, I really believe that we're living in these times. That the beast system of the time of the end is alive and well right now. It's growing before our very eyes. If only we can see it, it's there. And when we see these things, says Revelation, verse 15 says, Behold, I come as a thief. Blessed is he that watcheth and keepeth his garments. What a terrible tragedy it would be, brothers and sisters, if at the time of the coming of Christ as a thief, the community of the faithful ones had not read their books of prophecy properly. What a tragedy it would be if the Brotherhood had so many different views on prophecy that in the end no one had any view on prophecy at all, because it's just way too hard and we really don't know what to look for or what to expect, so let's just shut our eyes and not look for anything. What a tragedy that would be, given that this letter was written to the Bride of Christ that she might be ready, and that when the thief comes, that the garments might be kept, and that we might be watching for his coming. I think it's absolutely exciting, brothers and sisters, the times in which we live and the remarkable way in which prophecy is being outworked right now. It's all part of a continuous story that's been there since the days of Genesis. Soon it will all be fulfilled. The beast will be gone. The false prophet will be cast into the lake of fire, and the Lamb will triumph in all the earth. How vital that our own lives are stimulated by the signs of the times, by an understanding of prophecy, that our hearts might be ready for the coming.